This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Basically, they don't have enough access to water. They don't have enough access to proper food. And the access to health is extremely limited.
That's Marie Carmen Vignoles of Doctors Without Borders talking about the humanitarian crisis in Niger's Difa region. We'll have details coming up. Also, efforts are underway at the World Economic Forum on Africa to promote a new breed of African farmers called agropreneurs. And the humanitarian crisis in Somalia continues to get worse. And a whistleblower program allows people to report wildlife crimes online and anonymously. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story: as Africa grapples with a severe drought and famine threatens millions of people, experts at the World Economic Forum on Africa this week in Durban say food security needs to be a major part of discussions on advancing the continent economically. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg on efforts to promote a new breed of African farmers called agripreneurs.
The annual World Economic Forum in Switzerland is usually a high-powered event, but at this week's Africa meeting of the international organization, the continent's big players are welcoming the humble farmer, now known as the agripreneur. Agricultural economist Paul Makube, with South Africa's First National Bank, told VOA it makes sense to talk about farming when discussing building competitive markets and boosting innovation and technology.
For business to prosper, you need a situation where there is stability, and in terms of food supply and also production for the various regions of the Southern Africa and Africa as a whole.
Economists and agricultural experts say Africa's current food crisis cannot be blamed solely on a drought that has devastated large swaths of the continent. Drought, along with serious conflict, has doomed millions of people to dire hunger in Somalia, South Sudan, and the Lake Chad Basin of West Africa. But experts say there are serious problems in African farming, mainly the inability of subsistence farmers to make the leap into making a profit. Their obstacles include a lack of infrastructure to get goods to markets, competition from cheap imported food, government policies that do not offer enough support, unavailability of farmers' insurance, and limited access to technology. The Grow Africa Partnership works to increase private sector investment in agriculture, and its executive director, William Asiko, says he has seen the success of farming cooperatives in his native Kenya.
Supporting smallholder commercial farmers has got much more benefit for countries. Certainly it has worked in East Africa, where you have a lot of subsistence farming, and you're now producing surplus with all the work that's been done on productivity. It's about making sure that the cooperative system is working well so that farmers can aggregate their produce, get a better price at the market, and then working with processors and making sure that the policies are in place for them to invest and work with these farmers.
And the problem is demographic, says Birju Patel of the South Africa-based Export Trading Group.
The average age of small-scale farmers in Africa is between 60 to 65 years.
Oh, really?
That's a retirement age for everyone in this room, right?
Yes.
Now, how do you engage the youth to get involved in farming? So that's a big challenge for us now. And obviously, moving ahead with how the rest of the world is progressing, we feel technology is going to play a big part in that.
Growing Africa's next crop of agripreneurs will not be easy, experts say. It will take major investments in money, time, and attention. But they say the fruits of this labor are necessary to feed this continent's economic growth. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The latest UN assessment of the humanitarian crisis in Somalia says it continues to get worse while the risk of famine continues. More than 620,000 people have been displaced since November. About 7,000 of them have crossed into Ethiopia and Kenya. In all, more than 1.5 million Somalis have been displaced. Acute malnutrition is increasing in most parts of Somalia. Since January, more than 32,000 cases of acute watery diarrhea and cholera have been reported, as well as about 5,600 cases of measles. Famine prevention efforts have been scaled up to provide food, water, health services, and shelter. Donors have given more than $600 million for humanitarian aid since this year. The UN estimates another $200 million is still needed. More than 43,000 migrants have made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean to Europe this year. The vast majority are in Italy, followed by Greece and Spain. Nearly 1,100 have died trying to make the crossing, but before they board smuggler vessels, many have been brutalized. The UN Voluntary Fund for Victims of Torture says two-thirds of the 50,000 people it treats each year are migrants and refugees. Annette Karlamam is a psychologist and head of the Sweden-based Malmö Treatment Center for Persons Affected by War and Torture. The UN-supported center treats traumatized refugees who have made it to the European Union. She told VOA's William Eagle that some have been tortured by human traffickers, militia, and by those in refugee camps.
Well, Harvard University just recently, I think last week, published a study that made a very strong point highlighting the sexual abuse that unaccompanied minors are exposed to in refugee camps or detention centers in Greece.
Is that done by fellow migrants or is that done by staff?
I would assume it's both, but it's mainly staff. This is what the Harvard University study is trying to put forward.
Would most of the victims of torture be women and children?
We know that children and women are very much exposed to torture, but we know less about it, and especially when it comes to violence against women, because it often has sexual connotations. So we don't know quite how to ask properly in order to make women report what they've been exposed to. I can ask a woman, for example, were you tortured? And she said, no. Well, were you systematically abused by the prison guards? Yes. So we have to learn how to identify the kind of violence that women are exposed to, because they will answer differently. And then again, since it's often very, very heavy sexual violence, there is also the stigma and the shame and sometimes the jeopardy that an admission would put them into from their own families.
What safeguards can be put into place to protect against torture of migrants?
There's significant work being made by the UN FET and by all the centers and the legal consultants involved. We talked about the access to outside agents. I mean, there's the states, the legislations that should actually be followed. There should be a solution to the EU issue where we closed our borders and, I mean, reasoning about the consequences of that. But 65 million people are on the move, and it's only a small percentage that actually reached Europe. But what we see is that people in refugee camps or in prisons have access to outside agents like legal counselors, like ICRC delegates. I mean, those are the Red Cross delegates just making visits to prison. What we see is that when that happens, the violence often lessens, highlighting it, I guess, or just knowing that you're monitored somehow.
On the other hand, if I am a migrant taking a long trip from, say, West Africa through the desert to Libya to get a boat, I would be prey to torture by terrorist agents or bandits. Is there any form of protection for that where there is not a state agent in the area?
No, I don't think so. What we need to do is to establish legal ways to reach the countries of destination. It's an irony or a paradox that today's situation, we force people into situations where they're further traumatized by their trip or during their trip. What we need to do is to define wise migration routes and not force people into these conditions. That would protect them from the violence they're exposed to at the moment. start using the legal ways to apply for asylum. I mean, this is a human right, but today we have, for example, in Poland at the borders, Chechenian asylum seekers are denied at the border even, because they will just be looked upon as not refugees even before they're interviewed. In Sweden, we demand that people have their papers right. I mean, that you have the proper documents, which is in itself quite ironic because a lot of people do not have any documents. They do not even have birth certificates. So what documents are they supposed to present?
What efforts is the European Union or the UN making to assess and to treat tortured migrants?
The EU, I know, I mean, discussions are being held by the states. I know that they developed a protocol that is called Protectable, which is 10 questions that staff at the border should ask in order to identify victims or refugees that have been tortured, for example. That was a great project in the EU, but the protocol is not used. When it comes to the UN, I mean, the UNHCR are doing a lot internationally. I mean, they host several refugee camps and so forth. And when it comes to torture specifically, I think there are four organs within the U.S. who specifically work on preventing and highlighting and working against torture and having states follow the convention. So they do a lot, but obviously we're not all that successful. There's a growing tolerance for torture in the world.
That was Annette Carmelmann of the Sweden-based Malmö Treatment Center for Persons Affected by War and Torture. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle. Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Since the Boko Haram insurgency began in northeastern Nigeria in 2009, more than 2 million people have been displaced. While most have remained in Nigeria, many have fled to neighboring countries, including Niger. The Difa region of Niger has felt the full impact of the displacement. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says immediate action is needed to deal with the humanitarian crisis. Marie Carmen Vignoles is program manager for the organization, also known as MSF. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the crisis in Difa.
We have a very serious humanitarian crisis. We have around 240,000 between displaced population and refugees, plus 100,000 more of a vulnerable host community that they have been living in very basic conditions in refugee and displacement camps, that they are not providing the minimum conditions to this population. And they have been like that more than 2 years now. It doesn't seem it's going to change anytime soon, and we really believe it's time to respond to these needs of this population in a proper manner.
When you say respond in a proper manner, what do you mean?
Yeah, what I mean is that in most of the camps that they are based, camps that are quite big, we are talking of Gariwasama, around 30,000 population, or Kichendi, more than 20,000, or Tumur, more than 25,000, so it's big concentrations of population, and basically they don't have enough access to water, they don't have enough access to proper food, and the access to health is extremely limited. To give you an example, in the camps where MSF or Médecins Sans Frontières, we are not working, the population, they have to pay for the consultations and for the medicines, no? They don't have anything. We are talking of extremely vulnerable population that they have been displaced twice and three times in the period of the last 2 years, no? Because they moved originally from one village to the other, then there was another attack, they move again. These people that they have lost, their brothers, their sisters, their fathers, their mothers. So definitely we think that it's time to give an adequate response to the needs of this population.
Now, considering that a multinational military force has been fighting Boko Haram and has had some success, why, in your opinion, have conditions really not improved in Difa?
We have to consider one issue, that is how much the military intervention, the military response is successful. It seems that according to the information that is shared by the military, it seems that they are recovering some areas. Somehow, hopefully in the next months, maybe the population can start to go back to these areas that have been liberated, we can say, by the armies. But the problem is that the conditions nowadays, the everyday life in the camps in Difa, it's pretty harsh. As I said, there is not the basic conditions, not shelter, not education, not schools, no water, no food. So basically, it's time to respond to these needs. The development organizations, unfortunately, they didn't change quick enough to the emergency mood. And unfortunately, this is something that it has not been happening in the next months. The problem nowadays is that already, you know, the resilience of this population is very small, because they have been displaced for so many months now and several years. And combined with this, you don't have a proper response for the humanitarian organizations, then we have a problem. Regarding if these people will be able to go back soon to the places of origin, this is what all of them want. But again, it still is not clear, no, when they will be able to move back.
What are the main medical problems that MSF is seeing?
The typical ones in a refugee camp or displacement camp is respiratory infections. There are cases of malnutrition. There are cases as well of diarrhea. Unfortunately, we have as well a lot of women, they don't come on time to the hospitals that we are supporting to deliver in a safe manner. No? So we have as well cases of maternal mortality or the small kids that they are just born. They die because the delivery was not in a proper condition. No? Unfortunately, nowadays, for example, we have an ongoing outbreak of hepatitis E. This outbreak is directly linked with the poor sanitation, no? With the poor conditions of water and sanitation in the camps.
Marie Carmen Vignoles is program manager for Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. In South Africa, a Nigerian televangelist is due back in court today for a bail hearing as he faces charges of human trafficking and sexual exploitation. AFP reports 58-year-old Tim Amatoso was arrested last month in Port Elizabeth on 4 counts of sexual assault and trafficking charges. However, by the time he made his initial court appearance yesterday, more people had lodged complaints against him. Amatoso now faces 22 charges, and prosecutors say that number could rise. He's accused of luring young girls from his churches to his luxury home near Durban, where he allegedly assaulted them. He had been on the run for several days before being arrested April 21st. As the world grapples with a record-breaking spike in wildlife crime, dozens of animal species are being pushed to the brink of extinction. However, there's a resource available that can help crack down on these crimes. The Wildlife Whistleblower Program allows people to report wildlife crimes online and anonymously if they choose. Such crimes include illegal poaching and trafficking, destruction of rainforest, improper netting of dolphins, and many more crimes. Ashley Benetti is the chief operating officer of the National Whistleblower Center. She spoke with me about how the program works.
The Global Wildlife Whistleblower Program is an initiative of the National Whistleblower Center, which has been around for the past 30 years, experts in the field of whistleblower law. And this program was born after our executive director realized that many, if not most, of the wildlife protection laws in the United States contain whistleblower reward provisions, whereby if someone comes forward with information about wildlife crime, it results in a successful prosecution, they're entitled to monetary rewards. Those laws have been on the books for over 30 years, and no one was fully implementing them, and they have such great potential to combat the wildlife trafficking crisis. So this program jumped on that knowledge and is now a twofold endeavor. One aspect is educating potential whistleblowers about this opportunity, and the other side is creating a safe online reporting platform whereby individuals with information can come forward with that, report it, and then be connected to attorneys who will help them transmit that information transition to appropriate law enforcement and become eligible for those rewards that I had mentioned.
And of course, many people are witness to wildlife crime, but they may be afraid of the risk involved in reporting that. So how does this reduce that risk?
If the risks outweigh the reward, likely we're going to stay quiet. So many people with information will sit on that and not report it because they're afraid for their lives, their jobs, and rewards have been shown to incentivize reporting and help outweigh the risks that individuals face. I would also say that in terms of risk, this online reporting system, because it's confidential and allows you to report without identifying yourself, and because you're connected to an attorney, your relationship is protected by attorney-client privilege, so the attorney won't share anything without your consent. That adds to your safety. So it's not like you're reporting to a tip line where you don't know that your information is going to remain confidential. It's not like you're reporting to your superior who may be corrupt and involved somehow, or other law enforcement who may not have your best interests at heart. That I'm mostly referring to in foreign countries where there's weak rule of law. Those are big concerns for people.
So this works no matter where you are located?
Yes, with a caveat. People are eligible for the rewards no matter if they're U.S. citizens or foreign nationals. The crime can occur anywhere, but it does have to have a tie to the U.S. But under these laws, that can be quite broad. So for example, with Lacey and Endangered Species Act, if a good is destined for the United States or is leaving the U.S. or a U.S. person is involved, there's potential liability there. There's also two other laws, at least, you know, there's actually quite a few other laws, but two that we like to look at where there's broad jurisdiction. One of them is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and that criminalizes bribery at ports. With that, we see with wildlife crime, there's a lot of bribery occurring at ports to get the illicit goods onto ships, onto planes, into containers. So whereas you have the wildlife crime laws that haven't been fully implemented in terms of the whistleblowing provision, you have the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that is a really great route to start, but yet we haven't seen it used in this context as best that it can be.
So looking at it on an individual level, say I'm witness to seeing ivory being brought into the United States and I want to report this. I would go onto the website and make a report of it.
Our reporting platform is wildlifewhistleblower.org/submit-a-report. And it's a short form that's easy to fill out. And then you fill out a text box where you provide as much detail as possible in terms of what you saw and what kind of evidence you have. One very important thing is that every arena where whistleblower rewards have been properly implemented, whether it's securities and tax fraud, fraud on the government, act to prevent pollution on ships has a whistleblower provision, whistleblower rewards have been incredibly successful. And there's all the reason to believe that that model can be replicated in terms of energizing wildlife whistleblowers and reversing the extinction crisis.
Ashley Benetti is the Chief Operating Officer of the National Whistleblower Center. She spoke with me from Washington. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical gem. I guarantee.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.